voice of the Cape. The voice of the Cape. The Leadership Hour.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Zich Sain Higgins here with the Leadership Hour. This is between 7 o'clock and 8 o'clock, and between 8 o'clock and 9 o'clock, we're going to continue with the Legal Hour. So and we're going to have Faisal Bardin on it, and for those people that want to prepare themselves, we're going to be discussing family disputes and in connection with wills, inheritances, and properties, and everything to do with family disputes. So those people that want to listen in on that, between 8 and 9, we'll deal with that. But for now, we're dealing with the Leadership Hour, and I've got a very special guest here with me tonight. We've had politicians here, we've had people in the academia, we've had people in business, and tonight I think we're going to change a little bit, you know, people with serious skills. I mean, I always say, politicians get angry at me when they say, when I tell them they get paid to talk. But we've got people in house tonight. I mean, not people. We've got one lady. Her name is Dr. Shazia Peer. She is a pediatric ENT surgeon. Assalamu alaikum, Shazia.
Wa alaikum salam.
And she looks very nervous behind the mic, but I wanted to relax. I mean, the listeners of the Voice of the Cape are actually very friendly. They listen well. They ask a lot of questions, and they're very, very intrigued by people that give up their time to actually speak to the community. So thank you for that. So who is Dr. Shazia Peer? Now, firstly, Shazia, you are not originally from Cape Town. Where did you grow up?
I grew up on the East Coast.
On the East Coast. Yeah. Now, where is the East Coast?
So I was born in Durban, and I went to high school there and then studied in Johannesburg at Wits. And I then came to Cape Town to specialize in ear, nose, and throat surgery.
So ENT is ear, nose, and throat surgery. I mean, it sounds very, very complicated.
But the
word before that is pediatric, so I'm assuming that you're dealing with children.
Yes, yes. So ear, nose, and throat surgery has quite a broad base, and there are a few disciplines within that, specialties within that. So I am an ear, nose, and throat surgeon, but I further sub-specialized in pediatrics.
So the thing is, when I looked at the different type of people, you know, doctors and lawyers and whatever, in fact, I don't like even interviewing lawyers on air because we get so many of them on air. And I thought, you know, like, this is quite a specialized field that you are in, and you have done quite a bit of things, you know, like, you know, amazing things in your industry, like in terms of, but you need to tell us a little bit about, you know, the things that you've done that they don't do in the rest of the world, or things that, you know, and because I know you also go lecture all over the world, or you go assist people all over the world. You need to tell us a little bit about that, you know, how your pioneering endeavors. So, where do you want to start? You want to start with why you chose Cape Town, maybe, as a place to... I think you had Red Cross, eh?
You had
Red Cross. So, why Red Cross and why Cape Town?
Well, perhaps I can start at just a little bit before that. Why ENT and why ENT?
Okay, well, that may be a good place, yeah.
That may be a good place, because a lot of people have heard about ENT and what ENT surgeons do. And to some extent, we actually have such a wonderful specialty because we're invested in the senses, what people can hear and how they produce sound in order to speak and communicate. And those are things that actually improve the quality of someone's life. And to some degree, if that's impaired, it can affect their quality of life. So I've always known I wanted to be a surgeon from the time I was at medical school, and followed through with that. And to be honest, the University of Cape Town, in my opinion, and the Groote Schuur Institute, together with Red Cross Hospital, Hospital was for me a place that I chose to specialize in and to do surgery under Professor Johan Fagan and the other team members.
Professor Johan Fagan, he's quite a famous surgeon.
He is, yes.
So you worked with him?
I worked under him, yeah. And I came across to do my registrar training back in the day under him. And I really was still very fascinated with the human body and the wonder that the anatomy actually can show to us. And so the head and neck most certainly can provide that. It really is quite remarkable just how wonderful surgery is and even the field that we are in.
So now you've mentioned Groot Skeer, but you also at Red Cross. How does it two link up?
So we fall under one unit and this is under the University of Cape Town and the Department of ENT Surgery, and we basically have three hospitals attached to that, and it is the New Somerset Hospital, Groote Schuur Hospital, and Red Cross. And so even though I'm based at Red Cross, we fall in the larger umbrella of all these hospitals.
And how big is your team?
So we're in the state sector, not that big. We've got six specialists, six consultants that are responsible for the state sector in our drainage area. And it can be quite challenging. At Red Cross alone, there are just two of us.
Oh my goodness, two doctors, how many people?
Well, we see sometimes 30 to 40 kids a day.
A day?
Yeah, and you know, resources are always restricted, and we struggle. We struggle with our burdens of disease.
Okay, now, I've obviously, a lot of these things are very specialized, so of course, you know, I need to start. Easy for me to ask a politician a question, but I mean, when I deal with a doctor, then I need to ask a very specialized question, and of course, we need to make people understand what it is.
Yes.
So, what would you... you're a pediatric airway specialist. That's what I saw on that card. And,
yes.
Now, what does that actually mean?
I know. You know what happens when you take a specialty?
If somebody tells me they're an airway specialist, I thought it may be a pilot or something. So explain that to us.
Yeah, that can be misconstrued for many things. So, you know, within ENT, there's the ear, the nose, and the throat. And the throat is the gateway or the entrance into the lungs, really. And so when we talk about an airway, it's from the lips, or the oral cavity, the mouth, and it goes all the way down to where the windpipe or the trachea enters into the lungs. And so an upper airway pathology is anything that happens or goes wrong as it relates to breathing. So I am responsible for pediatric airway problems that relate to breathing difficulties.
So if a child can't breathe,
yes,
somebody rushes them to
hospital.
To the hospital.
Yeah.
So are you on call like all the time, or how does it work? I mean, so if you look at two doctors in the middle of the night, somebody comes in, my child can't breathe. What do you do?
So the type of breathing problems that we specifically look at are the upper airway obstruction problems. So say if somebody were to choke on a peanut
KFC.
Or KFC or something, and if for example it were to get stuck in the upper airways, or if they were whistling, for example, and a piece of that whistle went into their airway and got stuck between their vocal cords, that would be an absolute emergency, and that would be something that they would have to bring the child in for us to relieve the obstruction. And that happens even in the adults if there's an obstruction.
But I'm still not understanding how two people can deal with all these things. So explain that to us.
So we run a service in the state sector, and we are a tertiary hospital that is receiving consults. But thankfully, there are other ENT surgeons that are in the other hospitals that are able to facilitate this practice in other centers. But if it is a complex airway, if it's a problem where somebody has a complex disease and then also has an airway problem, they would come straight to us. There are some very specialized airway problems, like, for example, if I may say so, there are children who have bilateral vocal cord palsy. That's when the vocal cords don't move. Mm-hmm. And it could either be the way they were born. It could be due to an injury. It could even be due to surgery, where the vocal cords don't move, and so they don't move outwards to let air in when one breathes. And that can be a problem. It can cause respiratory distress, and they would then need to come to us. So even though we manage airway obstruction, we manage the usual things like big tonsils when someone sleeps. It can give them sleep-disordered breathing, and they can get sleep obstructive symptoms. We manage that. We take their tonsils out. But we also manage the more complex kids, the kids who have problems with their anatomy. So if they have a small jaw, for example, if they have an immature epiglottis, things like that we would manage. So the more specialized, difficult to treat cases we would see.
Shaza, I want to move before we, we're going to take a break shortly, but before we take the break, I forgot to ask you this. You come from an activist family. Yes. And I do believe that you need to tell the listeners. Your mother has been quite, she's been the mayor of Durban.
I don't know how it works.
I know something like that what I read.
My mother is the... she's the current deputy mayor of Durban.
Okay.
But I suppose she's been a voice she's been a voice for many, many people in Durban.
Is she also a doctor by profession?
No, my mother is not. She's a lawyer, a labor lawyer. And she was in politics for as long as I can remember.
Okay.
And she comes from a history of it through her family roots. And I suppose we've grown up around it.
And you, your activist background?
We've always had something that we could, stand up for. And I think in our household, there was always the need to step up and to advocate. And I think for me, my level of advocacy correlates quite well with what I do. And I see my job in many ways as a social responsibility to the patients that I treat. So I see it as an advocacy for them. So children who, for example, in the literal sense cannot speak. They're voiceless because they've got issues with their voice and to actually phonate or to breathe. That is my level of advocacy. I speak for the voiceless. And in the same way, I have...
That's really a literal way of doing it.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. And sometimes we give them voice with some surgical intervention. We're able to give them voice. And also for my trainees, I feel very fortunate that there are people who are training in my care and who are learning to be good surgeons, good doctors, and good individuals.
Oh, so you do training as well?
Yeah, we train registrars that are in our training program, and we train South African trainees who are registrars. We also train African trainees, and we have fellowships within our department.
Tell us a little bit about your overseas ventures in terms of going to do work in overseas hospitals.
My overseas exposure has been one of a more personal one. I really enjoyed my training at the Red Cross when I was a registrar. And so I felt the need to further develop my skill set and to become a pediatric ENT specialist, which is where we are today.
Mm.
And as you rightfully said, it's a niche practice. Mm. And even though it is, even as you said, a critical need because it's an airway obstruction, it's often not prioritized in training centers. And so there was no training unit here where we could learn subspecialties. And it is one of the challenges that we face in medical training. There aren't many subspecialist programs for many surgical specialties. And so for the greater part of the specialists, they would actually learn in their own way. They would self-learn or go overseas and observe. I was very fortunate, and I had the support of my team, my department, where I was able to go to Toronto in Canada to a hospital called SickKids, and I was able to learn the skill set that I'm now able to perform and
teach. Were you going as a... Were you seconded? Or was it you?
I applied for a fellowship, and then through a process of eligibility, I managed to get in, and I trained for 2 years. And I obviously had to fulfill the criteria, so I was an ENT specialist, and I then studied further and practically learned all of my skills.
So what did you bring back from Canada that was not available here?
So I was able to start start up a multidisciplinary team that is this pediatric airway unit that we have now. And it's actually quite remarkable because I think the time came where even within the structures of pediatric subspecialties, people were looking towards a pediatric ENT. So together, me and pulmonologists, pediatric pulmonologists and pediatric cardiothoracic surgeon with Sister Jane Booth, she's our tracheostomy sister, she's marvelous, she runs the Breathe Easy program. We all basically came together and on one platform address the needs of children with airway obstruction and airway problems. And what we in the past would do would be to bypass the obstruction and make a hole in the neck and do a tracheostomy. But in a sense, there was no urgency to repair the pathology, to repair the obstruction. What we are able to do now is repair the obstruction and either remove the tracheostomy or avert the need completely for a tracheostomy.
And government's involvement in this, are they providing enough funding for this type of...
It is, you know, with many, many niche practices, it is quite a problem. When we faced with struggles in equipment, in training, and also in just acquiring certain tools.
But so are they even aware that there's there's the challenge, but are they aware there's challenges? And what's the, what is the mechanism that this type of information gets to the decision makers, or are they even aware of it?
And this is the type of platform that we need. This is exactly it. This is absolutely where we need to speak about these things, because in as much as this is a niche practice, it is a critical one. And so my big challenge, and this is something I face because I work with children, and I work with children who don't have access to financial
resources.
Mm-hmm. Is that they actually have no way to get to us. And so they are, first of all, socioeconomically struggling. They also don't have access to physically get to us. So they would get referred to a community health center where they're seen, and that person may not have an idea of what the pathology is enough to get to us. And for example, the bilateral vocal cord palsy that I was talking to you about could be misdiagnosed as asthma for many, many years before somebody sort of realizes that, hang on, this could be something more, because they're refractory to medication. They're not getting better. So even just awareness of the conditions that we treat are not known. And what has made a difference is one, advocacy, like speaking on platforms like this, but getting the word out through patient care. And we're lucky with Red Cross is that they've got the Children's Trust, and the Friends of the Children's Trust like to ask us about the cases that we do and who are the patients who've had a life-changing event based on our care or based on something we've done. And like I mentioned to you earlier, we had this wonderful young girl who's 10 years old and who was born with bilateral vocal cord palsy and was basically living with a tracheostomy since 2 weeks of age. And with coming to our hospital and having an open airway procedure, just this week past, we were able to remove the tracheostomy and have her integrate into society and become a productive member, but at the same time live, have a childhood, and continue with developing like everybody else.
Now I want to understand, what would a private practitioner, what would they have charged for some way procedure like that? Because I want people to understand that these things are quite expensive. I mean, it's highly specialized. So just from a perspective of, if it was in private practice, what would somebody have charged for something like that? And I'm sorry if I'm putting you on the spot now.
Can I tell you something? That nobody in private practice has even done this surgery. And I would say not even in the country.
How?
We're doing them. And we're doing them because of the training that I was fortunate enough to have. But also we have the population that is coming to us. It is about not just the surgical time, the operative time, the patient staying in the hospital, but it's also the support structure. So having the nurses who know how to manage this, having, for example, the intensivist in the ICU knowing how to manage this, the anaesthetist, while we are in the surgery, knowing how to manage the patient, knowing what stents to use within the airway, how to feed someone after the surgery, even with the dietitian, the speech therapist, how do you speak after all of this? So it is a whole system, and it's the support of many people who contribute actively or passively that make this work.
I think it's important that people understand that, because I mean there's a whole lot of professionals involved, yeah. A whole lot of resources gets put into this type of operations. I mean, it's also good to know that the community, a lot of the people listening to this program right now, they are active contributors to Red Cross. We've always had.
Isn't that wonderful? Thank
yeah.
you.
I think of one specific lady, Auntie Warda Jacobs. Her husband, her late husband, used to also be a presenter on Voice of the Cape.
Yeah.
Auntie Warda and friends and family have an annual event, and all the proceeds of this high tea, whatever it is, it gets donated to Red Cross.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's just one example, and I mean, there's many others. So, I mean, it's good also for people to understand that people that do pioneering work, like yourself and leaders, that, you know, there's a lot of people out there punting for the type of work you do. But at the same time, we need to understand what type of
sure.
work people do.
Sure.
You know, that places like Red Cross.
I mean, you know, we had such a wonderful story. We have so many wonderful stories of patients who otherwise wouldn't have known that we have this care available if they didn't seek out help. And one of the children that we helped a few years ago, he was born with a very narrow trachea. And the trachea is the windpipe. And, you know, if you're born with a very narrow trachea, you can't get any oxygen in, and you can't get any air out. And so he struggled for a very, very long time before his dad heard one of my talk shows on Radio Sonogrense, one of the other things, and said, hang on, there's someone who knows how to fix our child, and came across us and actually came to Cape Town, and we were able to help him. And we
how did you manage the Afrikaans?
I didn't. I took the Afrikaans questions and answered in English. I'm embarrassed to say. But I, you know, we're not quite Tweetalig. I didn't grow up in Cape Town. But let me just say,
in Cape Town people are not Tweetalig either. We speak a very, very good dialect of Mengels. English mixed with Afrikaans. And that's why we don't call it Afrikaans, we call it Mengels.
Mengels.
Yes.
I'm probably even worse at that.
and the funny thing, okay, I'm deviating a little bit now. Just speaking about language.
Yes.
That the Cape Malay people were the first people to speak Afrikaans.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it was borrowed by the Dutch, and, of course, we got Afrikaans today. But the Cape Malay people were actually the original speakers of Afrikaans. And the first book was even written by Abu Bakr Effendi. So don't feel bad about it. You can learn Mengels, and we will happily incorporate you into that into the dialect.
I will take that gracefully.
Yeah, but coming back to you now, talk to me more a little bit about the challenges. I know that there's a lot of challenges for people like yourself who's serving the community on the level that you are. I mean, isn't it sometimes, you know, tempting to say, you know what, I'm going to go into private practice? I mean, has that ever crossed your mind?
Well, I do. I'm fortunate in a sense that I do a bit of limited private practice, because I provide the same service to the private sector for children with airway problems who otherwise wouldn't have this available to them. But to tell you the truth, I think within the state practice, and most certainly in academic centers, we face a lot of red tape and a lot of bureaucracy in trying to acquire things that we need. It is quite helpful to explain to the powers that be what the need is. And I think more than ever, we need to know our hospital administration and get to know the people even beyond that at the provincial level, and eventually tell them what our burden of disease is. For example, the burden of disease for hearing loss is huge. And if I can just tell you a little bit about the facts, there are 5 5% of the world actually is suffering with hearing loss, and that's something like 400 million people.
Sure.
And what is really very, very sad is that an overwhelming majority of these people are in the developing world, and that means that's us, that's sub-Saharan Africa. And we particularly are facing this when we see patients in our clinics. And what's even more sad is that the reasons for the hearing loss, the etiology, the cause of it, is something that's preventable. And this is really quite sad. So for many people working in the community, community health workers, if you work in clinics, if somebody does have a leaky ear or an infection within the ear, it is important to see that that is addressed, or a long-standing neglected infection can lead to hearing loss. So things that are so simple to treat can effectively reduce this risk of hearing loss.
Okay, Shazas, you're becoming quite popular here with all the questions coming through, and which is a very good thing. Somebody sent a message now. I must ask you about the gold medal you got for surgery.
What?
Is it even such a thing?
Oh, my gosh. Sure, that is, I think, you know, many people excel at exams and get medals. I did get one a long, long, long time ago when I was in my training through the college. But, you know, it's. I was very, very happy.
But what
about
was it for?
It was just a long while ago when I did my surgical exams. I think one scores the highest in the.
Oh, it's like one of those. Okay.
Yeah.
So, well, at least you have some fans here.
I know, that is a very long time ago.
To Voice of the Cape, which is brilliant. And
well done for bringing that up.
And the, it's actually somebody that's quite well known to the Voice of the Cape, somebody that is really involved with the community.
Well, that's good to know. I still try my absolute best at maintaining a high level of a high standard of care for all of my patients. And one of the things that you've mentioned is that we do travel overseas for two reasons. One is to get the message out there that our patients matter, mm-hmm. to get African statistics, African epidemiological markers out there, to show that African children and African people who are affected by ear, nose, and throat disorders matter, and that they take a stage globally. So that's one reason. And the second reason is to get the international perception of what surgical treatment is out there to help our children, and how we can modify it or utilize it to our structures.
Shazza, I want to ask you something. I think a lot of people are going to want to listen to this. You know, smoking, the whole concept of smoking, you know, like people allow children now to do vaping, you know, because it's in. And then, of course, they allow children to do oka pipe, which is like, because it's got a little bit of Arabic writing on the packet, then they think it's halal. And I've been speaking about this for many years, you know, but of course as an activist. But I want the medical view on this one. So the point is this whole concept of smoking harmful to your being, to your body? I mean, can you comment on that? Because, I mean, and then we'll derive questions from there.
That is a very loaded question.
I know it's loaded, but the whole smoking thing, you know, surely it must affect your throat. I mean, surely
there's primary smoking and secondary smoking. We call it active and passive. Mm-hmm. And so if I can explain it, someone who smokes, inhales the smoke and exhales the smoke, that's your active smoking. That has a direct effect on your airway. It has a direct effect on...
In other words, the active smoking, the puffing.
On the lining of the airway. So there are little hairs that line the airway that impairs significantly with smoking, and that decreases the clearance of particles. And so it can actually create problems within the respiratory system for smokers. And the secondary or the passive smoking has long-term implications. And what we have seen, and this is something that we are seeing more and more in the papers that are published now, is that children of caregivers who smoke are more likely to get upper respiratory tract infections, to get ear infections. And, you know, this can affect their developmental milestones during this period. And so my personal opinion and my professional opinion is that smoking is not, it's not advisable. There's also the risk with smoking associated to head and neck cancers. And we see that. We see that quite often, and we see it in patients who've smoked for many, many, many years. And so it has an effect on the lungs, on the airways, as well as on the soft tissues in the oral, the oropharyngeal cavity, as well as in the larynx.
So your medical opinion, as a highly qualified doctor, you're saying it's not good for you.
It's not good for you, but you know, it is up to the individual when it comes to active smoking. Most certainly, if it's passive smoking, I advise all of my parents and caregivers not to smoke around children, because that is not their choice. What we do for ourselves is different from what we impart on others, and it is about responsibility.
Shaza, I find it interesting that you're so blasé about, if you want to smoke, that's your problem. But isn't it your problem as a doctor? When somebody comes to you and says, listen, I've got something in my throat is not giving.
So if I was seeing a person who I felt... who I knew was smoking as a patient, I would advise him to not smoke. I think it's harmful for one. But in the arena where we're talking about, is it harmful to smoke or not? Yes, the frank answer is smoking is not healthy for anybody.
Well, that's a good answer. And I think and maybe that's what we've advocated all the years, you know, that that people should not be encouraging people to do this orca pipes. I mean, I've seen five-year-olds, you know, taking a puff on the orca pipe and everybody thinking it's okay.
I think that is not a good idea. I think it is, you know, it's also the beginning of perhaps initiating some kind of habitual format to promote smoking in the social sense.
And then, of course, there's this new thing, the vaping, you know, and everybody says, no, it's okay, it's, you know, it's just, but surely there must be something in there, this nicotine in there. Is there a relationship between nicotine and...
You know, I think the vaping on its own, it's even though it's been around for a while, there will be a lot of literature that's currently being published about it. And I think any form of... nicotine use can be addictive, and so that on its own is not a good idea. Many people use the vape to reduce their smoking addiction and to hopefully stop altogether. I think that is one of the that is most certainly the rationale in some ways, but I agree it's also not healthy, and there will be potentially in future the literature that may come out showing that it in itself is harmful, and some of it has already been released.
Okay, and then the other question is tacha.
I think that's also
smoking that could potentially be, but I mean I should put that into the same category like smoking, because it's
yes.
smoking.
Yes, so for me, if I have to take home, the take home message with regards to smoking is passive smoking is not good. So spouses who smoke in front of their partners, in front of their children, in community environments where the smoke has an effect on the others, is harmful and is not good.
Okay, now I want to ask you now, young people, young ladies listening to this program, and there's a lot of young people listening to it, they want to become an ENT surgeon, and I mean, what is their, what must they do? Where do they go? Where do they start?
Firstly, you must have a passion for helping people. You must see the humanity in medicine, because you face it every day. Sometimes you do everything right and you still don't get the outcome you want. So you must be there because you love what you do, and you want to help people. I think if somebody is interested in doing ENT surgery, they must have a feel for surgery and for working with their hands. It's a wonderful feeling.
So it's not just about, oh, I've got the title, you know, the thing that's in front of my name.
Yeah, I think, you know... Malcolm Gladwell said you must do your 10,000 hours to be good at something. You must actually love what you do. And, you know, I always go back to this one phrase. I love it. I love every word of it. What Rumi said, you know, about let the beauty of what you love be what you do. If you don't have that, then you're not going to necessarily have that feeling to go into work. I love what I do. So I go in knowing that today is the day I'm going to actively affect what I want to be doing.
Look, obviously all doctors don't choose public service. Once they've, you know, finished the public service, the 2 years or however long they must do it, and then they decide, no, now it's time to make money.
Is that still out there? Doctors don't really make money, well, at least.
Well, I think it's relative, I guess, relative. I mean, somebody would differ with you, but yeah. The point is, so what you're saying is if a young person wants to become wealthy, being a doctor, then it's the wrong place to be. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying one chooses what they want out of life, and they choose the path they take. If that is their purpose, then they will find it in medicine. There's a lot of money to be made in medicine. But within surgery, what is wonderful is that it's such an evolving field, and that's what's very interesting about ENT surgery. For example, I've got one of my colleagues, Prof. Libba, Darlene Libba. She's an amazing surgeon, and she works with an endoscope in the nose. And in the last couple years,
she does
endoscopic, so yeah. using a telescope to look into the nose, and she does endoscopic sinus work. But in the last few years, she's pioneered transorbital surgery. Now, what that means is you actually go along the wall of the eye. Mm. And this is remarkable stuff. So ENT...
So she does surgery going through the eye?
Yes, through the lateral side of the eye, the outer part of the eye, with an ophthalmologist. And so for me, ENT, ear, nose and throat surgery, and airway and head and neck stuff, it provides the substrate even to push the boundaries, but to incorporate all sorts of bioengineering in there. So,
Shaza, we're just going to go on a break quickly. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about, you know, what will encourage young people to get into becoming an ENT, and of course, how can the community assist you to actually get, you know, to get this on a, basically to get more resources to help more people.
Sure.
The Leadership Hour.
Okay, so we got Dr. Shazia Pia. She is a pediatric ENT surgeon. We're just listening to, you know, the type of things they're doing as doctors, and we're not even aware of these things happening. You know, we just think, it's normal basic surgery, and of course now we hear people are operating through, you know, through the side of the eye. And Shazia, but I do believe you've also, what was your highlight in surgery? I mean, before we now get to the funding part of, you know, so your highlight.
I think there's so many highlights, but the one that stands out is a procedure that we did last year. And why it stands out is because it's not just the surgery, but it's the story behind the surgery. It's a love story of two parents who advocated for their child, their unborn child, to have surgery at birth to save her life. And so this child...
But wow, did they know something was wrong with
herself? Yeah, it was quite a remarkable story. So mom went for her routine ultrasound at 25 weeks at a retreat, actually. And the ultrasonographer picked up that there was something not right. And this was on a routine scan, and they were fast-tracked to the fetal assessment unit at Grootegeluk Hospital. And what happens there is they do some more imaging of the mum with the baby, and they were told that the child has vocal cord stem bundle that are fused in the midline, and if she were to be born naturally, she would die, 100% mortality, because she wouldn't be able to make her first breath. Otherwise, everything else was looked okay. And so they were encouraged to terminate, because this was something that was very, very rare, but they felt that was not safe for the mom and would probably not be compatible with life, most certainly during delivery. And so the parents really introspected and looked for help, because mom felt that this was something she didn't want to just give up on, and she felt a connection with her child. And so they really researched, went on the internet, and found out about a procedure called EXIT, an E-X-I-T, EXIT. And so they contacted the unit and said, there's someone here who can do it. You need to contact them. And I was very lucky in my training in Canada. I was able to be involved in many of these cases. And so for me, this was something I could offer them. But there was a lot of resistance from many people, both from the medical side and the non-medical side, because this was considered experimental, even though it was 25 years in the making.
Can you imagine how the lawyers went?
Oh, I won't even mention. Gosh, we need a separate room for the lawyers. But what was really lovely was the fact that these parents fought for their child. And even to some degree as a specialist, as a surgeon, we also felt that.
But go to the part. What did you have to do?
So what I had to do was we as a team. So we had a team of specialists, pediatric surgeons, anesthetists, obstetricians. And mom had a C-section, a cesarean section, and the baby was delivered but still attached to the placenta. Mm-hmm. And that can only happen for a few minutes before you need to clamp the cord and
so how long did you have?
So in essence, we had about 10 minutes, but we had about 2 minutes to create an alternative airway. So the stem band are fused in the midline, the vocal cords are fused, so there's no way to breathe your first breath. So we bypass that and we create a little hole, a chaiki in the neck. That's the tracheostomy. But we do it in basically 2 minutes. And so okay. I had a wonderful assistant who's now my colleague, Jessica McGuire, and we together basically did this, and we had 2 minutes.
Okay.
And it was
and the
wonderful.
Child survived.
The child survived, and she's now 1 year old.
Wow.
Yeah, and she's doing very well. She's had a few adversities with time, she's growing well. And when she turns 3 years old, inshallah, we'll repair the voice box.
Okay, now let's talk about the bravery here. Because if things had to go wrong here, let's say the child died, then, of course, the activists would have come out, you know, the ethics people would have come out, because a child at that stage legally is called a nascituris. Mm. So people would have been acting for this nascituris. And were you not nervous at any point that things are going to go wrong and you're going to be sued?
And you know, if it's something that it has never been done before, there's always going to be people who would want to see you fail, really. Mm. But I felt very strong in my conviction that this is something I can do, this is something that I'm able to do, and this is something that would save the child. And you know, that morning, you know, I was very strong in my heart. I had my conviction and my iman, and I was content that this was the right thing to do all through the time. And I had the support of my department. I had the support of my professor, my professors, but all of them, and even of the larger community. I think everybody realized that this was something we could do. And the stakes were high, absolutely. But I was very clear that if something were to go wrong at the time, I would not push. Mm. We were lucky.
Shazi, as I said earlier, and you've got a lot of fans right now. I mean, this woman just sent a message now to say, mashallah, an absolute inspiration. Stay blessed. So, of course, this type of stories is good. Now I want to check with you. You mentioned limited resources. How is it possible then for community, ordinary people, you know, to get involved, you know, to support the type of work that Red Cross does, the doctors like yourself, your team? I mean, what in your opinion would be the best way to get involved?
I think one of the simplest ways is to see what we do. You can always come and see the unit and see how we're able to help children with airway problems and who have tracheostomies. And then the other thing to do is to help us with funding. We at this specific department, the ENT department, we're able to do more and improve the quality of our service delivery with funds. And the Red Cross Children's Hospital Fund helps us quite a lot. But with the community funding, we're able to do so much more. So people would direct their funds at our department, you know, the ENT department specifically. And this would definitely help us go a lot further. We're able to do more, get better equipment, and help more children, the children in need. I think what's also good is that even though I'm an airway specialist, we have a lot more within the scope of ENT. And one of the more needy parts of what we provide is the deaf community, the children who are hearing impaired. And that is actually one of the most challenging things, because many people in the community don't know that their children can't hear until it's too late. It's not something that is overt, it's not obvious. And so the signs may not be picked up. A lot of parents who have kids who are born who don't have hearing screening, for example. Very, very few centers provide hearing screening at birth. So I would definitely encourage people to screen their children, screen all their children. Go, you know, to the hospital centers and at least test your children.
Anyway, Shahaza, we've now come to the end of our program, unfortunately. I would have loved to have heard a little bit more, especially about, I mean, you mentioned some authors like Rumi and the other author that wrote Blink.
Malcolm Gladwell.
Yes. So hopefully that, that one day we can have you back on here and you can tell us a little bit about what inspires you as a leader and as a pioneer to read these things, because young people end up not reading. They think if they read a WhatsApp or they write a WhatsApp message that that's sufficient. So it's heartening to see people like you who do these things actually also have a habit of reading. And I mean, that's why you can quote authors, and I mean, that's beautiful. So from my side, Shazia, thank you very much. From the community side, we really, really appreciate you coming out here as a leader in your field to give us a little bit of insight into what you do. So we wish you well. Shukran very much. And I hope that we'll see you one of these days again.
Thank you very much for having me.